Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Beloved, we are gathered here today to worship at the altar of music and comedy. The giddiness and the harmony of a well-crafted comedy song brings great joy in abundance. Join the tinkling talents of David Timms and me, Phil Nickel. Sit back, turn it up, and enjoy Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Episode 3, Series 2. I'm Phil Nickel.
And I'm David Timms.
And here you're back with us again. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Thanks to all of our patrons. Thanks to all the coffees that people bought us. It's just been exceptional, hasn't
it? I mean, I've never drunk so much coffee. It's been glorious.
You've got a kid now, so you must
do you survive
on coffee to keep yourself
awake? I have no choice but to drink many a coffee throughout the day. I never used to.
Yeah.
No, but now I have to, yeah.
Yeah, so if you want to support the show and David and his child, go to coffee.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh and help us out. Buy him a coffee. Buy many coffees.
Yeah.
It's weird. It must be weird having a baby. I have nieces and nephews. Like I have four nieces in one family and they have children. So I have like 13 great grandnieces.
Grandnieces.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll
go with that. But because the show is about musical comedy and comedy songs and everything, children's songs do kind of fit into that novelty, and they tip over into actually hysterically funny or funny for children, you know, poo-poo fart songs.
Yeah, I absolutely. I'm at the moment singing. Your daddy's got a tickly chest, hurrah, hurrah! Because my baby can't actually just lie on my chest because I've got a hairy chest.
Well, so
there we go.
We're going to come back to that. Also on today's show, we've got the comedy song contest.
Yes, well, it's actually a competition.
We'll find out.
We will do, yeah. We're also writing a musical, aren't we?
That's right. We ditched everyone that's been listening. We've ditched the quickfire parody game, Stand By Bees, and we're going to be writing the third song of our musical.
It's very exciting.
And the musical, I think, now is called Desert Island Dicks.
It is. And we've also got an interview, as always, for you.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
We should trigger warn right now and say, if you're not a fan of the C word is going to crop up in this. But it's actually the K word because our guest spells it that way because he is
Cunt in the Gang.
So, well, I'm going to call you Cunt the entire time, or would you prefer to be called K-Man?
I'll leave it up to you. If you think your listeners can handle an hour of Cunt, because I sort of think once I start talking about the songs, it very quickly goes downhill anyway, so I think you might as well just give them a baptism of cunt from the start.
May as well go cunt straight in with cunt.
Go full cunt, I think, 100%
yeah,
cunt.
Yeah, full on cunt. Okay. So we're going to come back with some cunt later.
Until then, we're going to talk about kids songs.
Correct. Now, kids' songs are a funny one, though, because, I mean, first of all, it's the songs we all learn when we grow up. Like, everyone knows Inky Dinky Spider. Isn't it Inky Dinky? What do you call it?
Incy Wincy.
Oh, is it Incy Wincy?
Maybe it's different in Canada, in Canada.
Incy Wincy Spider. Maybe it is Incy Wincy Spider.
Maybe it is.
Maybe I just thought it was Inky Dinky. Is Incy Wincy?
It's definitely Incy Wincy Spider.
Oh, right.
Climbed up the water spout. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Cool.
Who actually sat down one day and went, "That's a great lyric."
I've
actually messed it up and gone Inky Dinky Spider. Rinky Dinky Spider.
Rinky Dinky. Is it under copyright? Are we allowed to talk about it?
Probably not. But I mean, there has been some great songwriters. The Beatles wrote Octopus's Garden. That's Yellow Submarine. Yellow Submarine is actually about drugs.
Would you say that Octopus's Garden is a kid's song?
No, but it's very childlike, though.
Ringo Starr wrote it. I don't know.
He was a great swimmer. Ringo.
Was he really?
Yeah, but I mean, John and George were the stronger swimmers of the Beatles.
Right.
But Ringo was had a lush backstroke.
I've got a theory that any time that Ringo used to bring a song in to see the band, he'd go, oh, guys, I've got a new song. George, will you listen to it? George? No, give it to Paul. That was my accent. Did you like that?
Yeah.
So then Paul would have a look at it, and they'd just laugh at him constantly. So they've got that one. They've also got Don't Pass Me By.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's another banger.
I think Don't Pass Me By is one of the better ones.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, strong songs.
Strong songs. Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash.
Johnny
yeah.
Cash is a children's album.
What's
you would think
the
men, the Men in Black.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's got him on the cover with a great big clown's nose as well.
That's terrifying.
Oh, I'm making that up. But I mean, there's Sesame Street. You know, there's the Muppets. SpongeBob has an album. Like, I mean, if you look at the extraordinary amount of comedy songs. Jonathan Richman, the famous, you know, like punk rocker, you know? Jonathan
yes,
Richman?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, he was a punk rocker. He came out of the CBGB's punk rock movement. But he's got songs like I'm a Little Dinosaur, I'm a Little Airplane.
I had a guy come up to me who'd been listening to the podcast, and and he said to me, David, you haven't done any Jonathan Richman yet. I went, okay, I'm going to do some research. And then today his name's popped up.
Really?
That was a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Well, Jonathan Richman is one of the biggest influences on our group, Corky and the Juice Pigs. His honest, he's created a character, and he's just so honest and earnest to that character that he can get a group of adults singing a song about an ice cream man.
Now ice cream man, please ring your bell. We're singing about music that I've learned to love so well. And ice cream man, please ring your chime on the afternoon.
I just love the gleefulness, childish glee. In fact, all of Jonathan Richman's songs are imbued with that kind of. He sings about corner shops, roller coasters, airplanes. I mean, little dinosaurs. It's really good for kids.
Yeah, there's lots of children's songs that have actually done really, really well as well. If you think of Bob the Builder, that got Christmas number one, I think.
Yeah, was it Christmas?
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
It actually beat. I know this. It beat Westlife's. Oh, what's the name of the Westlife song? He beat Westlife out.
I mean, it doesn't matter what the song was. Probably I know. It wasn't very good in comparison to that one.
Well, who's still working? Bob the Builder.
We're missing one really obvious one here, Phil.
What's that?
Baby Shark.
I don't know Baby Shark.
How can you not know Baby Shark?
I don't know Baby Shark. I know like songs from the Littlest Mermaid. Is it?
No, it's not the Littlest Mermaid. But you don't know the names of any of these things. Baby Shark.
How's it go?
Baby Shark, do 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 do. Baby Shark, do 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 do. Baby Shark, do 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 do. Baby Shark, Mommy Shark, do do do, and so on and so forth.
Wow.
It's had over a billion hits.
Now, well, that's obvious why.
Every single child literally on the globe knows that song.
Well, not me.
Well, you're not a child.
That's how I was, because I didn't, yeah, but I wasn't, we didn't really listen to stuff. I was listening to hymns. Like, baby Jesus, baby Jesus, baby Jesus, baby Jesus, mommy Jesus.
Mummy Jesus. Mother. Oh, I tell you what, actually, a friend of mine did have to do a church version of that for Christmas.
Yeah.
And it probably would have been almost exactly like that.
I guess sharks can be Christians too. I think there's certainly an alternative playlist that you can play for children, like so you don't actually drive yourself crazy listening to Daddy Finger or, you know, the songs. And that's why I like Jonathan Richman, because when I hang out with my brother's children or my brother's grandchildren, they get the guitar out and they make me play for them. And I'm able to play songs like by Jonathan Richman. I'm a little aeroplane now, now. 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 I said a wangity wang, wingity wang. I'm a little aeroplane now. Sit at the baseball park. It goes into the dark. I don't know how it goes. I say, oh, say, I'm a little aeroplane now, now. I'm a little aeroplane now, now. I said a wangity wang, wangity wang. I'm a little aeroplane. One more time. I said, I'm a little aeroplane now, now. I'm a little aeroplane now, now. Oh, I'm a little aeroplane now, now. I'm a little aeroplane now, now. I said a wangity wang, wangity wang. I'm a little aeroplane now. Yeah.
Well, I've got something reasonably like similar to that. Now, I find it fascinating how melodies can be reused over and over and over again. I'm talking in particular, there's... do you know Head, Shoulders, Knees and Toes?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what that's originally... what that song originally is?
Shampoo commercial?
No. No, it's originally a song called There Is a Tavern in the Town. Is a tavern in the town. So it started off as like a pub song.
Oh, yeah.
And it's ended up being a kids show, which, yeah, is about your body parts. I'm going to do another one, which was originally, I think, written in the First World War. Okay. But it had different words, as you can fully believe. This is the children's version, so... Do your ears hang low? Do they wobble to and fro? Can you tie them in a knot? Can you tie them in a bow? Can you throw them over your shoulder like a continental soldier? Do your ears hang low?
Of course. Now, I know that song from the Rude version.
And what would that be?
Well, it's
Phil?
About you replace the word ears with balls.
Ah, that makes sense. Should we sing that one? Here we go. Do your balls hang low? Do they wobble to and fro? Can you tie them in a knot? Can you tie them in a bow? Can you throw them over your shoulder like a continental soldier? Do your balls hang low?
It always reminds me of that one. Goes, Hitler has only got one ball. Goring has two but very small. Himmler has something similar, but poor old Goebbels has no balls at all. It's time for our... comedy song... What? I sing like an American announcer. It's time now for the comedy song contest.
It's a competition.
It's time for the songs in the Key of Love comedy song contest. We have great submissions. Keep them coming in. The comedy song contest. This week's submission is by a guy called Ashley Freeze.
He actually did a song in our first comedy song competition, didn't he?
But this song is called Glimmer of Romance.
Lady, with your sexy grey hair. Old lady, with your prescription underwear. Your skin so wrinkly and creased. Oh, how I love a gal who's not quite yet deceased. Old lady, my eyes grow misty over you. Your cataracts attract me, for your eyes are misty too. Oh, it would really be a thrill to share your pension and get mentioned in your will. I'll take you higher than your stairlifts. Oh, say you'll let me be your man. Vintage lips were made for licking, and it makes my pulse rate quicken when your pacemaker starts to kick in. Your temperament is bold and fiery, your pubic hair is old and wiry. Let's get naked, hot and oily. I'll put my bollocks on your doily. Oh, lady, apparently I don't even know your name. Is it Edna? Mary or Gladys, I don't care, it's all the same. I bet it's been 30 years since you last came. So please put down your silver frame. Let's misbehave until you're in your grave. So give your chin a shave.
So get your comedy song contest submissions into songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com.
That's correct. Yes, it is a competition. So please do send in those submissions.
Yes, there is actually contest prizes.
And there is competition winners.
So we've ditched the quickfire parody round.
We have ditched it.
And we've replaced it with David and Phil improvise a musical.
Yes.
And so each week I take a dictionary, we open the dictionary, put my finger down, word comes up. We improvise a song, and we're somehow going to write a musical.
We are, yeah. How have we done so far then, Phil?
Well, first week we had Monsoon, and we had David and Phil, great character names. They were stuck in a boat, heading towards Monsoon, trying to get away from Monsoon. And the second week, we had...
We went back to the mainland.
Went back, that's right. And it was David's fiance and her father arguing about which one of them that she wants should marry, because David is a juggler and Phil is in financial services. And then at the end of that week, I believe we went back to the desert island where David and Phil were coming around. And that's where we're at.
That's where we're at the moment.
And I think that's where we got the working title for the musical is Desert Island Dicks.
That's the working title.
So, open the dictionary. You can hear
it here.
That's
the dictionary. You can hear it.
Put the finger down. And the word is noodle.
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 Okay. Cool. All right.
Noodle.
Here we go.
Okay.
Ooh-ee-ooh. Life is hard on the island. Ooh-ee-ooh. It's starting to be a little trying. I'm so hungry, 'cause we've finished all the noodle. I'm so hungry since we've eaten your pet poodle.
Oh no.
I'm so hungry. We've had all the apples and all the strudel. What can I eat now? I am so hungry.
Oh, look over there, Phil. Oh. There's a coconut. I want it.
I want it too.
Well, I'm going to get it.
I think I'm going to get it before you.
I don't think you are going to get it before me.
I think I will, David.
I think that's my coconut.
I think it's my coconut, David.
No, it's mine.
Get away from the coconut, David.
No,
it's my coconut.
That is my coconut.
It's my coconut. You know what, actually? You're looking pretty tasty yourself.
No. No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
No, I'm not.
Yeah. I'll get the arms on you.
They were Phil.
A great stew.
Stop it! Stop it, you rotter!
Do you like competitions? I like competitions. If you like competitions, then please join our Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song competition and send in your submission for the competition to songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com. That's songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com. Join our competition.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's time for your favourite part of every show.
It's not my favourite part. It's your favourite part of every show.
It's your favourite part.
It's here on the Songs in the Key of Laugh. We interview some dynamic and fantastic musical comedians. And this week is no different.
Very much so.
Trigger warning. If you don't like the C word, don't listen.
This is
Cunt and the Gang.
The guest on today's show
guest
is someone you might know.
I love you, dude.
And if you don't, that's your own fault. But you'll know them soon.
You boy, you will.
This jingle has been personalized for a guest that we hope that you recognize.
So.
And this week their name is
Insert Name Here.
It's Cunt and the Gang. Or is it the Gang? Is it the Gang or is it just Cunt? I mean, how do we... What do you get called cunt often?
Call me cunt. I like it that way.
Okay. I'll call you cunt. Like, you know, because you go by K-Man, you go by Mr. Tuppence. What's Mr. Tuppence?
Tuppence is my kid's entertainer persona.
But oh, my God.
There's not much call for that these days.
No, really. But so, okay, we'll come back to Mr. Tuppence. I want to know about Mr. Tuppence. So, I'm going to call you cunt the entire time, or would you prefer to be called K-Man?
I'll leave it up to you. If you think your listeners can handle an hour of cunt, because I sort of think once I start talking about the songs, it sort of it very quickly goes downhill anyway. So I think you might as well just give them a baptism of cunt from the start.
May as well go cunt straight in with cunt.
Go full cunt, I think. 100%
cunt. Yeah, full on cunt. Okay. Okay, so
do you mind if I call you K-Man instead of cunt?
That makes you feel more comfortable.
Comfortable with a capital K. But
I think this is going to be my favorite interview that we've done on Songs in the Key of Laugh, because when I first came across Cunt and the Gang, I first came across Cunt. So you can't, there's nothing you can do about it. It's going to lend itself.
It's the gift
humor
that keeps on giving.
It really does. It really does. I sucked off a bloke. How's the song go?
I sucked off a bloke in brackets. I didn't like it.
Someone sent that to me. Someone sent that to me just as a random friend. Actually, when I first moved to the UK, my large group of my friends are from Essex. They're from Brentwood, and one of them sent me that, thinking I'd find that funny. I did, obviously, very funny. But it was more the video. It was the amount of time you'd taken on the video to make a funny video to go with it. So it wasn't just like a. It sort of added a level of
yeah. The video kind of came hand in hand with that, because that was a bit of an anomaly, that one, because up until that point I'd been going for maybe like 7 or 8 years and I hadn't done any cover versions or parodies of existing songs.
Right.
But that was one that just kept tapping me and going, you've got to do it, you've got to do it. And in the end, you know, I recorded it and just put it on a B-side of one of my little EPs I was selling at gigs. But because I played it once or twice and it just went down a storm. And I don't know, it's one of them things that, because it's a pre-existing song that people already know the format of, and then you kind of subvert it, it sort of gives you a little head start into people are already wanting to laugh at it before they find out what you've done with it.
In musical comedy, parody is kind of the lowest form of, like, you can just change a few words and then people know the song and they get into it and you get laughs out of it. However, that particular parody it's elevated to another level because of the ruthlessness of the parody. It didn't even strike me as being a parody when my friend sent it to me, but he's obviously been drawn to it because he just knows the other song and thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And had not, and because you're from Essex, I guess he just thought Essex, you know how people in Essex sort of do support themselves and love all things Essex.
Do they?
Yeah.
I'd love to get in with this group of friends of yours from Essex who are all really supportive of each other's work. Because I've lived there for fucking 49 years and I haven't found anyone that wants anyone else to get on.
You've been hanging around the wrong people. You've been hanging around the right. You got to go to Brentwood, mate.
Yeah, they all seem so supportive in Brentwood.
Yeah. That, well, that's how Towie ended up there. The only way is Essex, except for Brentwood, because they just put up with anything.
No, they just appear to be supportive for TV's sake. Like, the minute them cameras stop rolling, they're all just like, they're going on TripAdvisor and slagging off each other's nail salons, saying, I had a bad vajazzle there.
At one point, I was walking through Brentwood. There was, you know, those fish tanks that you can get your feet eaten by fish.
Oh, really?
Do you know the thing I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I think I've only ever seen that on, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm. I didn't know it was a thing in England.
Yeah, no, first time I saw it was in Thailand, which is where anything goes, but it's basically a fish tank. You know what I'm talking about, David?
Yeah,
a fish tank. You put your feet in it, the fish nibble all the dry skin off your...
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was one point in Brentwood, there was three shops in a row with these fish tanks with people sitting, but with people actually using them. I've never seen anyone actually use them.
It's like an Essex aquarium.
I tell you this, the women in Essex have very kissable feet. That's all I'm saying.
When I used to go nightclub in Southend, you wouldn't have found any girls with kissable toes there. They barely had kissable mouths.
So you're from Basildon.
Yeah.
I mean, you're already launched into a career of cuntishness.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm a product of my circumstances and surroundings.
Exactly. Now, I don't mean to deride Basildon, but I have performed there and performed in a snooker / strip club.
I know where that is. Well, yeah.
What, do you know what's it called? It's called the Gentleman's Castle, I think.
Oh, is it? It used to be called like... What was it called? Was it called Cats or something?
Cats. Yeah, it was called Cats. Yeah, you know the one. I played it when it was Cats, and then I played it when it was the Castle. There's a snooker club in the back where the gigs run presently, and it's they're a really nice gig, actually. They're actually quite supportive of the comedy and up for a laugh, which is probably why I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm assuming your sense of humor has come out of that sort of ability to just completely take the piss, which would be in turn why my friend from Essex sent me that clip, because he thought it was just ridiculously funny. Would you think
I think it's also if you're seen to be taking anything seriously, everyone goes, out of necessity, yeah. But I also think that, you know, maybe the reason you found everyone supportive is because you've got this exotic accent, so they're like, whoa. God, I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, right.
Whereas when I spent, I was like, oh, it's just that prick.
Well, yeah. Well, it's like, when did all of this start? How did it all start? What made you think, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a cunt.
Do you know what? But nothing ever happens like that, does it? It's a kind of gradual kind of seeping in. Like, my old man was a builder, and so... You'd hear the most horrendous jokes, like all through my childhood, you know, the most horrendous jokes. So I think I just developed a level of, what would you call it? A level of numbness towards anything offensive.
Yeah.
I started sort of writing silly parody songs, I suppose, like as a teenager. We're not really writing, you know, but just kind of like thinking, if you did the words to that, you did the words to Bryan Adams' Run to You as You're Gonna Crap Your Pants or something like that, you know. all the usual stuff. And then it doesn't really work, but then when you're a teenager, you just like anything to do with poo, willies or bums is just like the funniest the funniest thing in the world. And really, I've just not really grown out of that.
Still are the funniest things in the world.
Yeah, they are the funniest things in the world. So you were in a band called the Pubic Cube.
Yeah. So I started a sort of comedy punk band with the group of us that used to hang around at the Tech College Common Room. And half of us weren't on courses or anything. We'd just go there to kind of hang out, you know, where there were some teenage girls. I will say we were teenagers at this point. We weren't like 50-year-old men.
Yeah.
A lot of us kind of silly sods sort of gravitated together, and we formed this band called Serious Problem. And it was sort of a comedy punk band, and punk purely, you know, really just because none of us could play instruments or anything. And so there was 14 of us, and I think out of that 14, only four or five could play instruments, and the rest were all just squabbling over two microphones. And so that kind of went on for sort of 4 or 5 gigs. And then I met a mate who met a mate through work called Andy, who lived on the 13th floor of this block of flats. And he had like a synth set up, you know, like a little home studio, 4-track set up in his bedroom. And went back round his for beers after work one week, and he played us some of the songs he'd been working on. And like they sounded like fucking Depeche Mode from this bloke that sort of lived on this 13th floor of these flats, you know, backing vocals a lot. And so I just kind of, you know, sort of started to aspire to that, and he helped us get set up with a little kind of 4-track keyboard set up. And then I just started recording my own stuff from there. And it was me and Andy kind of formed a synth duo called Pubic Cube, and we'd just go out and play like working men's clubs and talent competitions. But it was a real, like, because of the kind of subject matter, I've always liked writing songs about the stuff that other people don't really want to write songs about. You know, this is stuff you might talk about when you're down the pub with your mates and you know, the kind of things you wouldn't hear on daytime radio. So we'd sort of play them out at these talent competitions, and people would either love it or hate it. You'd get a really polarised reaction. People would either want to buy you a pint and be your best friend or punch you in the face in the car park.
Right. I've got the image of you turning up at like the village fete and getting up and doing your two keyboard thing, and just loads of 70-year-old women going, "Oh no, oh dear." Yeah,
there have been a lot of occasions when it has actually been like that. My first ever show at the Edinburgh Fringe, I was, you know, like on a kind of comedy compilation show, and it was pissing down a rain, and I've sort of, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm playing I Sucked Off a Bloke and Chips or Tits to all these middle-aged shoppers that are just in sheltering from the bad weather. And died on my arse and just thinking, oh, fuck, is this what the Fringe is like? And, you know, it is half the time.
It is, though, yeah.
What I love about that story, though, is that in the middle of you doing that, you're actually thinking, oh, I'm dying on my arse, which is not actually, you'd think, from now you're telling the story, it's heroic. But at the time, it was painful. It was painful for you, even though you knew that you'd written the thing that was going to have that reaction. No?
I think, though, you know, as much as, you know, I started off doing it in its current form just to be as silly and offensive as possible. Yes. But there's something deep inside you as a human being that wants acceptance. And so when you're playing this song about sucking off a bloke on a building site in front of a load of middle-aged soaking wet women, you know, not soaking wet in the right way either, and dying on your arse, there is a bit of you thinks, oh, God, what am I doing with my life?
I had that experience when I was in Cork the Juice Pigs. We were playing an afternoon show at a college, and we had a song called Burn Victim Girl, and we got to that point. It was like we were standing on tables. Like the guy that booked it didn't even have it set up properly, so people were just eating their lunch, and we're singing away Burn Victim Girl, and the whole place went completely quiet, and then like completely silent, and then someone started going. Someone yelled, fuck off, and someone else went boo, and that started like, and we already know what we'd done. Like, we knew it was like, it was meant intended to be funny. It was so over the top that how could you think we mean it? And then we were packing up our stuff, and the janitor was there, and he was like a full burn victim with like, had like half an ear, and he had his janitor outfit, and he was pissing himself laughing, and he just went, ah, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life, because I knew they know me and they take the piss out of me all the time, but when you did it, they suddenly felt like, you can't do that. You can't make fun. They thought you were making fun of me, and that's what went wrong. And he went, but I knew that's not what was happening. And he just was helping us put our stuff in the car going, and he just was crying with laughter going, that was so fucking hilarious. It's brilliant. And in a way, what he felt out of it is that the people at the gig were defending him, even though he got laughed at, made fun of, and he's the janitor all this time. It's actually, he finally felt like he was included in their group. They all hated us and got rid of us. And there's something about offensive comedy that does that, that you either get into it, enjoy it, and become part of the group, or you feel defensive of everyone else that's listening to it.
But do you know what? I think it is sometimes, is I found it makes people angry.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like, you know, having seen that a lot across the years, like especially like at the Edinburgh Fringe because I was doing the free festival, you know, people haven't always got that that investment where they've kind of gone and paid money for a ticket, and you might get a big group of people come and a couple of them just have a really terrible time, and yeah. they'd start off with their arms folded and they'd get higher and higher and higher, and you'd see yeah. them like actual anger, you know, it made yeah. them really yeah. angry. But I think part of that is just not feeling part of the joke, and you know, and if you don't understand what everyone else is laughing at and you feel excluded, that's where the anger comes from. I don't know. Yeah.
Do you, as you talk about it and as you talk about those people whose arms steadily get higher and higher and higher in defence, you do have a slight grin on your face as well.
Well, because I used to take it very personally, you know, and you'd think, oh, you know, like everyone else having such a good time, like, why are you there ruining it? You know, and also the masochist in you focuses on the one person in the room that's having the worst fucking night of their life.
Absolutely.
But then I kind of learnt to embrace the awkwardness of it and embrace their awkwardness, and it fired me up. And you know, sort of my last few runs at the Fringe, if there was someone who really wasn't enjoying it, I'd just single them out. And just say, like, mate, you're going to have to fucking get on board with this, because otherwise I'm just going to keep picking on you. And, yeah. you know, and then you kind of get the power back, you know, and yeah. And can kind of go on and do the rest of the gig unencumbered. Whereas if you're kind of watching them out the corner of your eye just thinking, God, they're having a really terrible time, it does affect you.
Yeah, I was thinking, it made me think of, there's an American comedian called Neil Hamburger who's just really... He's a character. It's quite obviously a character. He's got like yeah. a comb over and glasses and the suit. You know who he is. Yeah. And it's quite obvious meant to be funny. Offense. That's why it's funny. It's funny because it's offensive. But I've seen him so many times where people get brought along, do not real somehow can't see that it's a character or don't care whether it's a character, and get so unbelievably offended by what he's doing. And he, similar to you, has found a way of making that part of the making it even more uncomfortable for them, to the point where you people get up and leave. I think he finds it funny.
Yeah,
the character finds it funny. And the reason, one of the things I enjoy is taking someone along. Like, I take David along going, you got to watch Neil Hamburger. And then he's up there and I'm sitting watching my friend going, to see how people react. You must get that all
that,
the time.
That was the spot for, but you know, where I was touring for sort of nearly 15 years, that was the spot for the people that would come back and see us year after year. Their sport would be watching the new yeah. people and their reactions and seeing the people yeah. that were going to like it and the people that weren't going to like it. And fuck me, like half the time, you know, you'd see big groups of people just watching someone to see where, you know, see where their uncomfortableness and where their anger was going to go throughout the course of the gig.
I've got theories. I mean, I know I don't really believe anything that I say half the time, but I've got theories on offense because of the nature of being in Cork and the Juice Pigs. We would make each other laugh by making the joke that you make to your mate, that you know your friend's a centered person. There's no way he actually would mean that offensively, so it feels okay to say it, to express it to a mate. But then you start expressing it to an audience, you have to try and bring them in and make them feel like they're your friends. And
yeah.
you have that ability to do that, though, because you obviously, otherwise people would just be storming out all the time. And as Neil Hamburger, some people do leave, but most people stay and get it.
It's not something, you know, as I sort of discovered doing the Fringe, because I come from outside the comedy circuit, I didn't realise a lot of the skills of comedy, you know, and about getting, you know, I didn't understand this thing about getting people on board with things until quite late. And it was only because I'd sort of, you know, I found my own little circuit of band venues and pubs, and just used to play that, and more people would come along. And, you know, and through doing the videos on YouTube, people kind of got on board. So I always understood the thing about, you know, you start off your set with the kind of ones to kind of draw them in, and by the end, you know, they're all stood up on their feet clapping and cheering as you sing about the rape of a paper boy.
Oh, my God.
But sort of what I didn't realise you know, you sort of get sucked into that and feeling like it's acceptable. And it's only when you kind of do the short, you know, the short kind of sets at the fringe as part of a compilation show, and you put something that's in the latter half of your set in to, you know, into a 10-minute set, and you sort of do it to a dry audience in the afternoon, and you're like, oh, fucking hell, maybe that isn't acceptable. Perhaps I've just become desensitized to it. But, you know, yeah, it's purely because you haven't had the chance to go through that process of getting them on board with it before you kind of hit them with the hard stuff.
So how did you get into the live scene? Like, was it on from the YouTube videos, or how did you get into it?
Well, to start off with, I was just kind of, I was playing like band venues, like locally in Basildon. And then it was just at the time that MySpace and YouTube were kind of kicking off. And so I set up a MySpace profile and started making YouTube videos like in about 2005, 2006. And then from that, I kind of started to get like little band venues kind of contacting me and saying, will you come and play in Leicester and Liverpool? And then I started to kind of piece together my own little tours. But they were always like band venues and pubs, you know, never kind of comedy clubs. It sort of grew like the wildlife of Australia, you know, completely independent to, you know, a scene. You know, it just sort of developed on its own. And that was the strange thing about it, was the people that kind of come to see it were quite a disparate group of people, you know, from various kind of scenes and age ranges. And what they had in common was like just a sense of humour or wanting to laugh at things that you didn't always hear sung about.
Yeah,
I remember. I mean, it's become more difficult. I don't want to continue this whole conversation to be about the offensive nature of the act either, because I don't think that's fair. I personally don't think that's fair. But we entering into an era of people being knee-jerk reaction with social media and everything. The things that you used to do was MySpace. Do you just fly in the face of it and just go, I'm going to do whatever I want, or are you thoughtful about your approach to it?
I don't know. I think in a way I always have been thoughtful of my approach, but sometimes, you know, I kind of work on the basis of sometimes if you feel like it's a good idea, you just have to do it before you talk yourself out of it.
Right.
Because, you know, I know like several of the songs that I would play towards the end of my set and you wouldn't play at the start of your set, I had sat on sat on my computer for 4 or 5 years before I felt that, you know, well, I never really felt comfortable enough to put some of them out, but some of them I just recorded them just to see what they were like. And I didn't really have any intention of putting them out because I thought maybe they were just the other side of, you know, whatever that line of acceptability is. But then when you actually take them out and play them and see, you know, the laughter and joy it brings people, you think, fucking hell, if I'd have self-censored that one, no one would have heard that. And like some of those ones ended up being the most popular ones out of my back catalogue.
It is quite a back catalogue as well. You've got, is it 10 albums? Ten albums more?
I'm not quite sure how many it is, but it is lots. When I first started going, I've got a mate who kind of runs an independent record label. And I think I was just about to release my second album, and I said to him, "Have you got any tips for us that can kind of get us ahead of the game a bit?" And he said, "Mate, you've just got to like be consistent and just keep putting records out." He said, "You just need to have a big back catalogue, because every time you release something, you'll get knock on sales for the others, and that's how you make a living out of it." And so I sort of, you know, took that to heart and just tried to do an album a year or every couple of years. You know, like when you're touring a lot, it's sort of hard sometimes to kind of get in the zone to get all, you know, to be, because touring's sort of different, you know, you're in a different kind of headspace. But it's become a lot easier since iPhones, because no matter where you are, you can put your ideas down. Whereas before, you were kind of trying to hum them round and round before they disappeared off into the ether. So now when I write a new album, I kind of go back and you've got 2 years worth of like, you know, a single line or a song title or whatever to kind of mime through for your starting points.
It is good advice, because it means just keep writing everything, all your ideas down, write them all down, and they all become usable at some point. And to put something out regularly, to constantly create stuff, whether you are or not censor yourself and hold back. That's really good advice. Are you like, do you play, what do you play? Do you play piano? Do you play guitar? How do you go about writing songs? Like, do you start with an idea?
I'm not a musician. I sort of play keyboards to record into the computer, but I'm not of any kind of proficient standard where I could perform a song on the keyboard for you. You know, I don't play two-handed or anything, but it's taken a long while to kind of say to myself, you are a songwriter, you know. Yeah. And I think, you know, I had to write 200 songs before I felt, you know, I'm a songwriter. I always just thought I was just someone who just got these, you know, got these ideas, but those ideas are, you know, turn into songs.
Yeah.
And you kind of the craft of it, you sort of learn along the way.
Yeah. I think there's, when you are creating stuff, it's like, how much of it do you need to have before you can kind of give yourself that title? How many songs do you need to have written to be a songwriter? How many minutes do you have to have of stand-up before you can say that you're a stand-up? How many times must you have performed it? Because up until that point, I guess there's just a massive imposter syndrome that is kind of sat upon your shoulder. Have you ever had that, Phil?
I still have it. Yeah. I mean, I still sometimes, depending on the mood or if I haven't eaten or whatever it is, where I think I've been an imposter and I shouldn't be doing it. But not like as a songwriter. Do you know Wayne Shepherd, Gary Lestrange?
Yeah, that was the reason I kind of went up to Edinburgh was, you know, I just kind of went up and I saw Gary Lestrange up there and was just like, fucking hell, I should be doing this, you know. Found it really, really inspiring, his show.
He wrote all of the music on a PS4 or whatever. Like he used a his gaming box. He had the ideas,
yeah.
And he said the same thing to me. He'd never thought of himself as a songwriter, but I mean, his production and all his stuff is amazing. He now does music for television. He composes incidental music for horror films and stuff like that. But he still doesn't think of himself as being a musician, and it's really bizarre to me. When you saw Gary Lestrange, did you see someone? What I saw was someone being so free, like so. He was doing something really different, wasn't he?
Yeah. When I saw him, it was the third show, Beef Scarecrow, which was just off the chain, fucking mental.
Mental.
Like his character had kind of obviously like had a drug induced breakdown and kind of come back with this psychedelic third album. But from that, I kind of, you know, chased back to the first and second albums, which are, you know, they're just brilliant, and it's sort of parody, but without, you know, but parody in a genre, and like especially from someone that grew up with kind of electronic, you know, that kind of electronic 80s music was, you know, completely soundtracked my childhood and teenage years. To see someone parody in such fantastic detail and be absolutely fucking on the mark, but without being being cheesy or crass.
Yeah,
it was just so fucking funny, just so funny.
So he'd written it on a PlayStation.
Yeah,
I think that now on an iPad or on any computer at all, you can be a musician because you are learning the art of a particular instrument, and the instruments have just changed. So you don't have to play the guitar, you don't have to play the piano to be able to make all of these amazing sounds. But the fact that you are making them and that they sculpt themselves into a song, you are therefore a proficient musician. And I mean, what the stuff that you make is on point as well. It's I am a session musician. I'm a session piano player. I heard your when I've listened to your stuff, I've gone, somebody, you've got a musician in the background making all of this all come together and stuff. But is it all just you?
I'm pleased you think that, but I've completely hoodwinked you.
That's great. This is exactly what I was thinking when I listened earlier. I was like, I bet it's him, but it's really good.
But you know, any bits that you think sound like they've done by a musician, I would have had to slow down to 51 BPM and then speed them back up.
Brilliant. I have to do that sometimes anyway, so that's all right. So I think there's... I've got one quick question about the... We know we said we were going to move on from how offensive some of the material comes across as. Has it worked, or have you tried it abroad?
Well, sort of. I went to Australia in 2013 and done Adelaide Fringe and then like a little show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And I was quite surprised that in Australia, I found the audiences to be more conservative than over here with their kind of general mindset, like, because we're sort of, you know, sort of growing up in the 80s, we were sold the Foster's No Worries Mate thing, you know, and the blokes from the Castlemaine Forex, you know, putting one bottle of wine on for the ladies and it collapsing the cart. But I found over there, if you kind of, you know, sort of especially touching on religion or you know, paedophilia, they were just like, no, I'm not having that, mate. And you're like, oh, fucking hell, you know, like over here, you know, everyone's waving their arms about and singing along to them ones. But but yeah, I definitely found over there, like, that line was, you know, no, mate, don't go there. No, anything but kids, mate, you know.
Yeah.
You've lost Cunt in the Gang as a moniker. Or you dropped it in like 2016 or 17 or something.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
Sort of in retrospect, I think I just kind of burnt out by doing too many gigs in a short space of time. And also, the tours were, you know, I know I wasn't playing a quarter of the gigs that some comedians do every year, but I was playing gigs in places with no green room or changing rooms, and so you're getting changed in a toilet cubicle with a river of piss on the floor, like, you know, trying to stand on one shoe so you don't get piss on the hem of your onesie, and you know, and also I was touring around in a Ford Fiesta on my own for most of that time, and so you turn up at the pub and you're on from the minute you get there, and you do banter from, you know, from 6:30 until you kind of go on stage at 10:00, and then you come off and flog all your own merch and do banter until you kind of get in the car door with the last couple of piss people, like fucking Dawn of the Dead, going like, you know, up against the windows of the car, and you just trying to get the door locked quickly. And ultimately doing that every night, I think just fucking took the joy out of it away. But the touring is where you earn the money. And so, you know, it's taken me like to have to stop touring to make me realise I do enjoy playing gigs. What I enjoy most is sitting here at the computer and that kind of creative process of, you know, taking your idea and crafting it into a song, and where that, you know, where those little stars of inspiration that kind of come out the sky and just kind of land while you're making the songs. That's the bit I really love. But the you know, the touring, obviously, it's good to go and play them and see people's reaction. But I just think what maybe I'd do differently is I would have just picked and chosen the gigs a bit more carefully in the last few tours, and I think that might have dragged it out. But every time I tried to kind of shorten the tours down and make them a little bit more manageable, you'd kind of, you know, get people go, oh, but Cunt, they're going to really miss you in Swindon. And you'd go like, oh, all right then. And you'd kind of end up, you know, also kind of working for yourself. It always just felt really fucking weird turning work down, you know, and having worked like doing painting and decorating and various, you know, work doing odd jobs for the council and all those things sort of up and, you know, into my kind of 30s, the idea of turning down £250 to just go and be on stage for an hour just felt a bit weird, you know, and I don't think I really got out of that mindset, and it was only kind of finishing it and then going, oh, fuck, you know, I do actually miss playing live, that you kind of think, well, maybe I should have just, like, I always thought wellness was a load of bollocks, but it turns out it's, you know, through the pandemic, a lot of us have realised that it is actually a thing, you know.
Yeah, Yeah.
So you're not planning to go into children's entertaining then anytime soon?
I could, you know. It's nice to be able to have that as a string to me bow that, you know, to fall, to fall back on.
Yeah. But you bring Mr. Tuppence back for sure.
Tuppence could be back any time. I've still got the suit and the makeup.
So Boris Johnson's a cunt.
He is, isn't right? he?
Yeah.
And
on top of that, you've written a song about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two songs. In fact, Boris Johnson is still a cunt. Went to number 5, is that right? At Christmas?
Yeah.
Right.
So like Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt. Went to number 5 in Christmas 2020. And then Boris Johnson is still a fucking cunt. Went to number 5 in Christmas 2021.
Great.
Amazing.
Great. And I think that's really says a lot about how we feel about him, that it's maintained a top 5 level.
I mean, I think in a lot of ways he's more of a cunt than last year.
Yeah.
But the trouble,
I think had it come out maybe this week, now that we know more about his wine and cheese, it might have gone to number 2, number 1.
But you know, the idea of, you know, he's back catalogue of fucking corruption and lies, and the idea that his wine and cheese has pushed us over the edge, he's very British, isn't it?
It really is. Him paying someone to beat someone up didn't get him the attention that the wine and cheese got him.
No, it's crazy. I mean, I know it's like a kind of cumulative effect, but if every time he does something, it's the worst thing he's done, you know. But I always think, you know, like when you see people smack their kids in a supermarket and you think, fucking hell, well, if they're doing that in front of everyone, I wonder what they're doing at home. Like, this is just the stuff we've found out about. Like, what the fuck? There's definitely others. There's other stuff out there. But I think the way the media works is they don't give you it all in one go, do they? They just kind of drip it until, you know, until all the right-wing tabloids are ready for him to go, and then they'll turn on him as well.
Yeah. Yeah, which is hopefully soon.
I mean, hopefully, but, you know, like, I always think, like, you know, like when Richard Hillman, the serial killer, left Coronation Street, and when Mrs. Mangle left Neighbours, you always think, oh, they're so awful, these people. I really want them to go. But then when they're gone, it's just like you're left with this hole in your life that you haven't got anyone to hate. But looking at the leadership, the prospective leadership candidates, you know, there'll be someone step forward.
I don't know much about your personal politics. I'm assuming from that song that do you side with a left or right?
Do you know what? When I released the song last year, I didn't think it was a political song. I thought it was just a statement of fact. And, you know, and I quite like the idea of someone serving me with court papers and me getting a chance to prove why he was a fucking cunt.
Yeah, right.
I didn't think it was a political thing. And people naturally assume that because you attack the right, that you're from the left. But I just think that the whole system is so badly fucked. And every election seems to be about, well, if you don't vote for them, then they're going to get in. And so you're just forced to choose who's the least biggest cunt every time. And the system's, you know, it's the system that's broken. And the fact that we've only got Labour and the Conservatives to choose from, and no one ever, you know, the people in power are the only ones that are going to be able to change it. And they never will, because it'd be turkeys voting for Christmas. So we're all just stuck in this dysfunctional, broken system that just feels like it's going to go on forever until there's a revolution.
Do you think that's why the people of the Northeast, who are mostly working class people, voted for Brexit? Not because they actually thought it might have been a good idea, not necessarily because they're all racist. They actually just wanted to see some kind of change. They didn't know what it was going to be, but they thought it's just like tipping over the fruit cart just to see what happens, right?
I think that is part of it. But, you know, you've also got Nigel Farage in there, who somehow has hoodwinked people into thinking that he's a proper person like us because he's got a pint of beer in his hand. But he's not. He's a wealthy banker and he's a dangerous, narcissistic cunt. You know, He just stokes the fire and then just fucking stands back and watches it burn. And ultimately, you know, Brexit was about lots of people being told that they could take back control. And it was to do, I think, like largely to do with immigration, and people confuse that immigration with Muslim immigration, and you know, and the way society's changed, you know, and Nigel Farage's rosy painting of the golden era of Britain when everyone was leaning on their fences, talking to their neighbours, and everything was great. But it's, you know, it's all just bollocks, and people were just sold a big lie, I think. And that's why people get so angry about it, is because it's horrible to feel like you've hoodwinked. And there's something in us as British blokes that will argue that fucking point that we were right, even though we know deep down that we were fucking hoodwinked. The idea that someone's put one over on you is just too much for people to take.
I want you to take a little bit of there's a little bit of pride that I feel from yesterday. I was going through Facebook, and as I went through, there was an ad for, you know, for Cameo. It wasn't Cameo, it was another thing. But who was on there but Nigel Farage? And it said he could do a message for anybody's Valentine's, and I just it made me die inside. I was like, would somebody actually do that? But you know, they might do.
But who's been doing? Someone's been playing that trick on Farage by getting him to do. Who was it? It's someone that plays pranks. It might have been Simon Brodkin or someone, but getting to send messages because he just reads the messages because you write the message, he reads it, takes him 2 minutes, he makes 30 quid. he's that desperate. And they were putting in white supremacist language all the way through, like slipping it in and making him say things he didn't even like kind of like, you know, Chris Moore is doing the cake thing where he's saying stuff he doesn't even realize what is he's saying.
Yeah.
And then showing it to everyone to show what an absolute absurd human being he is.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just a fucked up world that Nigel Farage is on Cameo, and you know, I mean, it might be a bit of a laugh, mightn't it, getting him to do a Valentine's message?
I don't think that's how my partner would see it.
if you were Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt. Was not a political song, which I can see that. But do you think, like, it's like a punk movement, I'm going to say the things I'm not supposed to say, I'm going to do the things I'm not supposed to do. There are a lot of people that are anarchistic that might find you sort of a figurehead.
I don't think really anyone listens to what I'm saying. I think because you know, I wouldn't call it a career, but you know, my existence in the last 20 years has kind of existed so far outside of the mainstream of what's going on. You know, no one really listens to what I say, and that's why I can sort of say what I like, because you know, there's no comeback, because the Christmas showed, you know, a song called Boris Johnson is still a fucking cunt was in the top five of the charts, and no newspapers reported on it. Because I think it's so outside of what that comfortable worldview that the tabloids sell to their readers, you know, they just don't bother with it. You know, and I do understand it's got swear words in and stuff, so it's hard to report on, but I still think that is news. You know, if a completely unknown song from an unknown artist had got in the top five, I think that'd be news. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think because there was a lot written about it, actually, like this the last year especially, there was a lot written about the fact that this song had done so well, and I found it amazing seeing that there were all of these letters blocked out for a song in the top five, but it made it look like it had extra stars to it, so it made it look extra shiny. I find it phenomenal that a comedy song has managed to do that, though. And I mean, you must be twice, not once, but twice. Does it make you proud? Like, there's a Grammy for comedy songs. I like, you've got to the top five twice. I don't understand why you're not being talked about for a Grammy for it.
I kind of think they weren't really, I wouldn't have called them comedy songs, you know. They were just sweary protest songs.
Sweary protest. Fair enough.
Well, it's a bit like Tim Minchin's song about the Pope. You know, it's not really a comedy song, but it makes me laugh. You can't not smile and
laugh when you hear it.
No, but there's some great lines in that, you know, and there, I think there's more, you know, there is definitely more comedy in that than there is in my two top five hits. But the I like saying it like that. But
you should.
The point of it was just, you know, to give a very clear message that wasn't bogged down in why I think he's a cunt. Yep. You know, just to kind of give people the opportunity to go, well, do you know what? I think he's a cunt as well. So let's do something about it, because if you don't do something, you do nothing, you know, and at least it kind of gave people something to hang their hat on and just a, you know, just a platform to voice their anger and frustration about it.
I reckon the door is wide open for when he does go, though. The door is wide open for you to really stick the knife in and get yourself a number one there. I will be fully behind it. If you need somebody to play the piano at 130 BPM, I can do it. What? I'm keen.
In real time, fucking hell.
I know, right? In real time.
Right, so.
Got another question quickly. In Edinburgh, I, as I walked around, saw lots of, would you call it artwork, Philip?
Oh, well, was that one year where you put your sticker onto other people's posters and people took offense with it. I personally found it very highly amusing.
I'm glad you did, because otherwise it'd be the elephant in the room. But can I just clear up that it wasn't me putting the stickers on the posters? I gave them out and told people to do it, They went and did it, but I thought that everyone would just take one because the stickers were shaped like cocks and bollockses, like a crudely drawn cock and bollocks. And the idea was, because I was too lazy to give out flyers, people would use the stickers, you know, instead to stick over the other act's posters, and that would help promote my show. But I thought everyone at the gig would take one sticker, you know, and go and place it carefully on the poster of their choice. But in the first few days, people were just grabbing big handfuls. And so, like, within a week, there were, like, hundreds and hundreds of these crudely drawn cocks on all the posters all over Edinburgh. And all the people that had spent, you know, hundreds and thousands of pounds on their big posters on these poster sites, obviously, you know, took umbrage at seeing a picture of them with their mouth open and a crudely drawn cock in it.
Yeah, who took it the worst? Or was there some one or two people that took it really badly?
Within 5 or 6 days, Alex, who was running the free festival, called me up and said, "Listen, mate, you're going to have to stop giving them stickers out," because he'd had like the fringe, you know, Fringe Central on his case, and they'd had Avalon and who else was it? Avalon and Underbelly threatening legal action, and there was like. But one of my mates, who's a comedian, sort of drinks in all the bars where the comedians drink, said, like, she'd heard a group of people going, "Well, that prick's going to get his comeuppance. He's going to be sued for 50 grand. Oh, I heard it was 3 grand. No, 50 grand. And then I got shoved up against the wall by one angry comedian who hadn't even had a cock put on his poster, but it was the idea. He said, "If I see one of those cocks on one of my posters," I said, "Well, no one's actually put one on yours yet." But it was just the idea of his face coming into contact with a cock made him that angry. He just grabbed me and shoved me up against the wall.
Tell us who it was. Who was it? Wow, that's amazing.
I don't know who he is or anything about him.
He's quite a mild-mannered guy. It's just really funny.
Not on that occasion, he wasn't. He was really... He had the fire in his eyes. I could see little reflections of cocks on his retinas.
But it did win you the Malcolm Hardy Award.
I've got it up on my mantelpiece.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So this is my favourite part of the interview. It's where we hear a song from our artist.
Yeah, so, see, my favourite part of the interview was introducing Cunt.
And my favourite is where I get to hear you do a song. So that's great. It just shows that it's our favourite part of the show.
What's the name of the song?
I've had trouble picking just one song to do, but I've settled with this one. It's called "It's Just a Butterfly."
"It's Just a Butterfly" by Cunt. The Cunts? cunt and the gang.
Cunt, 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 cunt and the gang. As long cunt as there's the some cunt in it somewhere, it's me. It was my mate Jim's mum's funeral, and I wanted to attend. So he knew that I was there for him in this tough time for my friend. The service was quite beautiful, and as we looked at the flowers outside, I put my arm round my old mate as he read the cards and cried. Then a butterfly landed on a flower. My friend took comfort in the sight. He said it was as if somehow his mum was telling him she was all right. I was quite moved by his words, but I couldn't let it pass. So I said to him, "Oh, fuck off, Jim. You're talking out your ass. It's just a fucking butterfly, a butterfly, a butterfly. It's not your mum, it's a butterfly. It's no more than a beautiful moth. It's just a fucking butterfly, a butterfly, a butterfly. If you're seriously telling me that's your mum, then you can fuck right off. 'Cause there's a worm and there's a slug, there's a load of ants and a little bug, and you haven't said that they're your mum, so get this in your head. There's no such thing as angels, fairies, saviour, Jesus and Hail Marys. It's all made up to try and make you feel better, 'cause when you're dead, you're dead. Now stop being such a big fucking baby and let's go for a pint."
And that's Cunt in the Gang, and it's just a butterfly. Thanks for joining us on Songs of the Key of Life, Cunt. It's really, really nice to speak to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Cheers,
no,
buddy.
No worries. See you. Bye.
Nice
bye.
One. Cheerio.
Goodbye, adios, farewell. You'll be glad to hear that we think that your interview went well. But we have other things to get on with now, so you're gonna have to go. I'm sure our paths will cross again, but whoever really knows? It's been fun, it's been musical, it's been comical at times. But now we have to leave you, so goodbye, goodbye.
I'd like to add how sincere that laughter sounded at the end of the song before you've actually heard it. I'm never going to believe anything I ever hear on podcasts again.
Well, that brings us to the end of Songs in the Key of Laugh for another week.
It
fantastic.
Does.
That was Cunt in the Gang. I love that, man. He's an erudite. Well, he's a special. That's a special.
Erudite. Very good word there,
thank
Phil.
You very much.
Yeah, you've been reading the dictionary, haven't you?
I have. You have. I've had my finger in the dictionary.
Hey.
Don't make me eat you, David. If you'd like to see more or hear more from Cunt in the Gang, why not visit their website, cuntthegang.co.uk.
And at that website, you can buy Boris Johnson is a fucking cunt t-shirts and shoulder bags.
And don't forget to continue to send in your submissions to the Songs in the Key of Laugh Comedy Song Contest.
And please keep supporting us at patreon.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
Or buy David and his baby a coffee at coffee.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye. That'll do.
Right, this is it. Do your balls hang low? Can you swing them to and fro? Can you tie them in a knot? Can you tie them in a bow? Do you get a funny feeling when they're hanging from the ceiling? Or you'll never be a sailor if your balls hang low.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.